And Wednesday is
Love Boat Day, of course. It's also the day we brush off the cobwebs and allow Felix Bunnell to crawl out of his crypt and bring us a moment in history. And it's one of Seattle's most treasured stories, the Mercer Girls, the two shiploads of eligible women imported from the East Coast by Captain Steubing and a plucky pioneer by the name of Asa Mercer, because there were lonely lumberjacks and they were very marriageable and they needed brides. So we know that story, but Felix, you have the nearly unknown story of the bride ships of British Columbia, which actually arrived first.
Yeah, so Asa Mercer might have been inspired by these. That could be part of the mystery. But there's a new exhibit at the Vancouver Maritime Museum called The Girls Are Coming, A Visual Voyage of the Bride Ship Tynemouth. It's curated by an artist named Tracy McMenemy, and we'll hear from her in a moment. So in Victoria on Vancouver Island in 1862, not counting natives, men outnumbered women 100 to 1. meanwhile, in England, the mother country, there were 600,000 more women than men. So Reverend Edward Bridge of Victoria got to thinking, and he wrote a letter to London seeking women willing to travel halfway around the globe. And through the efforts of a few organizations, the SS Tynemouth, a steamship, set out from Dartmouth, England, with 300 people aboard. 60 of the passengers were the so-called brides, and Tracy McMenemy told me that many would be considered children today.
They were as young as 12, and I don't know how old they were. I mean, probably early 30s, but the majority of them were quite young, and they were working-class women who were very poor, and most of them are orphaned from their families because their families couldn't help them. When I first started researching them, I thought the orphans meant that they didn't have parents, but I think a lot of the families at that time couldn't afford their children, so they put them into these orphanages.
And so the trip from England to Victoria by way of the Falkland Islands and San Francisco took 99 days. Tracy McMenemy says that on the voyage, the brides lived in the very lowest section of the ship.
There were no portholes or any fresh air. There was no light. It was completely dark. There were lots of rats and cockroaches. There was no sanitation. And because it was a steamship, obviously, there was a lot of soot everywhere. So I think it was pretty awful. And they never came up. They were locked down there for the duration of the trip.
So not exactly the Love Boat.
Were there any nice accommodations aboard those ships? I have yet to hear of any Atlantic voyage in that era where people had good accommodations.
There was a first-class section, and actually some of the women, the marriageable women, actually came as first-class passengers, but the bulk of them weren't down below decks to protect them from the men, allegedly.
So
once the Tynemouth arrived at Vancouver Island, it still wasn't exactly a pleasure cruise. The brides were first taken to the Navy barracks at Squimalt, and then they were put aboard a Navy gunboat and taken into Victoria's inner harbor. It was quite a spectacle.
There was one woman that was grabbed by one of the miners as soon as she walked off the ship, and they left and got married 3 days later. The rest were brought to in front of the legislative building, and they washed their clothes and got themselves all cleaned up, and then they paraded them around the town two by two. And then they brought them to the barracks in the Squamalt, and they kept them there for a few days and some for several weeks until they found them work.
And Tracy said that often most of them cried themselves to sleep every night. I mean, it's not necessarily a pretty situation. Anyway, so there weren't prearranged marriages. Most of the women were placed in homes as domestic servants, though some had come specifically to be teachers, even though it turned out there weren't really any schools, which it's a whole other story. Anyway, ultimately, several of the women were courted and did, in fact, marry local men, as well as some Americans who were up there for the gold rush. I told Tracy I couldn't really decide if all this felt like a charitable relief effort or human trafficking. She said that as far as she can tell, none of the women or girls was coerced into boarding the ship in England. She also said to think of the bride ships as a form of social engineering to address scarcity in one area and surplus in another, and to make Victoria look more like England, culturally speaking. I asked Tracy McMenemy if the social engineering actually worked.
You know what? I think it worked to some degree. I think it worked in that certainly the woman, well, they changed the culture. They changed the focus of it just being gold and lumber and beer to having some sense of culture. I think that they did change the scene. Yeah, they were definitely pioneers.
Yeah, so there's a total of four of these ships. Maybe upwards of 200 women came between 1862 and 1863. I've never heard of it before. It's not very well known in British Columbia. Tracy's been researching it for a couple of years, and not very many people she's talked to had actually even heard of it. Of course, the Mercer girls around here have been part of our mythology probably since the moment Asa Mercer announced his audacious plan. It's been part of our mythology, right? This, you know, the lonely lumberjack. There was a musical called Calico Cargo that was produced in Seattle back in the 1940s, written by local people. And there was, of course, the TV series 50 years ago, Here Come the Brides. That really took this Northwest myth and made it a national myth. And I was unable to confirm any my suspicion that Asa Mercer was inspired by the Bride ships. But there was steamships and sailboats going back and forth between Seattle and Victoria. And the news was the most precious cargo, right? What's going on in Victoria? I'm sure this made news down here. I haven't been able to confirm that. But Mercer must have been inspired by the Bride ships.
You know who paid for this?
It was these social service organizations, one associated with the Anglican Church, and then a progressive early feminist organization. I think it's called the First... The Female... I can't remember the name of the society, but they were people who were trying to do social engineering, trying to make Victoria and British Columbia a better place.
More
and address the
civilized.
Yeah, exactly. And those women theoretically did that. They brought these English influence to Victoria that we still feel today.
Felix Bunnell's features are all on mynorthwest.com. Felix, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Imagine a road rage detector or a fatigue detector that would monitor your facial expression and ultimately could even pull your car over if it detected that you're not able to drive responsibly. This kind of thing could be possible with a new kind of artificial intelligence technology that can basically read what your face is saying. It's being developed by a company called Affectiva. And Gabby Zeiderveld is the chief marketing officer for Affectiva. You can actually download an app, which I've done, Gabby, and it's pretty remarkable. It will detect, for example, joy, anger, frustration, disgust, or what it perceives to be disgust. So can you explain how this technology works? How did you get a software program to recognize human facial expressions?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, we have built algorithms that can analyze in real time as people express emotions on their face. And the idea here is that our algorithms look for facial muscle movement, and facial muscle movement can be mapped to very specific facial expressions, and different combinations of facial expressions make up an emotion. So in very simple terms, that's how it works. Now, to actually develop algorithms that work that way is not trivial. It requires massive amounts of data to recognize all kinds of patterns in these many different faces.
So you've been collecting data for a long time now. How much data do you have? How many faces do you have in your database?
Yeah, good question. We've analyzed almost 8 million faces. I think it's 7.9 million faces in 87 countries. And we're adding to that data set every single day.
And you've recruited volunteers who are willing to put the camera in their car. So that would strike some people as kind of creepy. For your volunteers, how do they feel about knowing that there is a camera not just watching them, but evaluating what they're feeling?
Yeah, you would think so. But with the studies we've done, people generally are comfortable with that and also typically quite quickly become unaware that we're analyzing them. Now, obviously, we explain very clearly what we do, what we analyze, how we use the data, how we store the data, because, of course, potentially there's concerns about data privacy, because we're ultimately analyzing people's faces, we're analyzing their emotions, and that is very private.
Right. And if this is being used to determine whether a driver, for example, is drowsy, I'm sure that insurance companies would love to get a hold of data like that. So how do you protect it?
Well, so ultimately what we do is we provide the technology that analyzes the human face. And that technology is then sold to a car manufacturer who integrates it into their vehicles. And it's the car manufacturers that then also determine how the data is stored and where the data is sent to.
Then it would be up to them then what to do if your software detects that the driver is tired, whether to pull the car over, or I think one system would actually wiggle the seatbelt so it would jolt you awake again. Is this reliable enough to be entrusted with that kind of responsibility?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely reliable enough and accurate enough that it can identify a certain state. So, for example, when you think about drowsiness, right, it's not just is someone awake or is someone asleep, right? You want to be able to detect levels of drowsiness, but also you want to have mindful adaptations in the vehicle. So, for example, if I'm driving and I'm yawning once or twice, I don't necessarily want all these alerts going off or my car with self-driving capabilities pulling me over, right? That would not be appropriate. However, if I'm about to fall asleep, yes, that would maybe be an appropriate intervention. So in that example, being able to understand levels of a certain state and then being able to design vehicle adaptations that are mindful and respectful of that. a steering wheel that jolts. It could be a visual alert on the dashboard display, or it could even be an audio alert, because a lot of vehicles now have these virtual assistants. And it might say, hey, you're getting drowsy. You should consider pulling off the next exit. And here's a map that will take you to a resting place. And here's a route that we recommend you take.
Now, with any technology this powerful, I can imagine certain governments wanting to make sure that this software is on everybody's computer. All computers have cameras now. I mean, what do you do about that kind of scenario?
So we walk away from those scenarios. It's that simple. We do not sell our technology into scenarios where there's no opt-in or consent. Actually, in the early days of the company, there was an offer for investment, a significant amount, about $40 million, from a funding entity, if you will, that was essentially government surveillance. The co-founders of the company walked away from that funding. That was not where we want this technology to be deployed.
Mm. Would that investor have been China?
No, actually, it was the U.S. government.
It was the U.S. government? Really?
Yes. Surprising, wasn't it?
Well, maybe not. So an entity
maybe
of the U.S. government.
Maybe not.
Gabby Zeiderveld is the chief marketing officer of Affectiva. And tell us about the app, the one that I have on my phone. Anybody can download that, right?
Yeah, in Google Play or on the Apple App Store, AffDexMe, AffDexMe. People can download that and play around with it.
Right. Gabby, thank you very much.
Dave, thank you so much.
I've had this on the phone for about a month now, and you basically just aim it at your face, and then you see a series of white dots which appear, so you can tell that it's thinking, and then there are several parameters, and you can check what they are. Joy, disgust, anger, and there are a bunch of other things, too. It can detect when your lower lip is curled, whether your eyebrows are raised, just to demonstrate how quick the technology is. And as she says, though, it's not to them to decide how it's used. It's up to whoever buys it and decides to install it in the automobile or maybe in the refrigerator. Maybe the refrigerator would tell you, no, you really don't want the cupcake. Progress on an issue we've been following for a long time, the untested evidence in thousands of sexual assaults. Car Radio's Hannah Scott was there as the governor signed a bill to clear the rape kit backlog.
10,000 untested rape kits sitting on police evidence shelves for years, in some cases, decades. They were discovered in 2014, but progress was slow. The lab was short-staffed, the equipment outdated. For years, a team made up of a handful of lawmakers, law enforcement, and sexual assault survivors have worked tirelessly to change that. And this year, that work finally paid off as the legislature made clearing the rape kit backlog a priority and got a bill to the governor's desk.
This bill is an important next step in our efforts to end the backlog of untested rape kits and ensure better support of sexual assault survivors. Thousands of survivors have provided evidence to law enforcement that has never been tested, even decades after the alleged crime. Survivors clearly deserve better than that from the criminal justice system.
The governor signing a bill yesterday that finally requires every one of those kits be sent for testing and that testing be completed in 2 years. It also creates a new high-tech lab and hires more staff to cut testing time down to just 6 weeks on future kits. It also ensures rape victims can get a rape kit at no cost and includes new training for police who deal with survivors. When the governor signed the bill yesterday, it was an emotional moment for everyone who worked so hard over the past 5 years to get this done, including the bill's sponsor, Representative Tina Orwell.
It's hard to find words. I mean, so many survivors we let down. We can tell today, no more. There will never be a kit sitting on a shelf untested in this state again. We will seek justice for survivors like we should have years ago. I'm just so proud. I'm so proud that everyone came together to make this happen. You know, if you think about all the survivors, they assumed we had tested their kits. It breaks my heart to think of all the people that realized we didn't. But I just want them to know it's fixed. Within 2 years, they will be tested.
For sexual assault survivors like Leah Griffin, this sends a strong message and helps provide some closure.
For years, the evidence of possibly the worst thing that ever happened to us just sat forgotten on a shelf. And now we know that the state says, this is important, what happened to you matters, your pain is valid, and we're going to do a complete and thorough investigation into what happened to you.
Leah says, unfortunately, the word that all of these kits had sat untested for years really sent the wrong message to rape victims, a message that nobody cared. that many believe led to victims not reporting what happened to them. But Leah has a new message for those survivors.
There are champions like Tina Orwal out here that are tearing down barriers, that are reforming the system in radical and important ways. And while we still aren't done yet, there's still more to do. What happened to you matters. And at the very least, if you submit for an evidence collection kit, it will be processed.
State Patrol Captain Monica Alexander helped to craft this bill and says it is a huge step forward for public safety.
It's about safe communities. It's about getting people off the street that shouldn't be there. People that have been free to continue to rape or walk free after they've raped someone for years. It's about stopping that. I don't want people to feel confident I can rape someone and my kit won't be tested for 12 years. Big deal. No. That's not the way it's going to be. So I'm looking forward to this.
As for what comes next, work.
There's a lot of work to be done, but getting our scientists to actually have the tools that they need to do the work is important. It's so important, and they're excited about it. The people in our Vancouver lab, you've been there. You see them. They are passionate about their work, but they need the tools to do their work, and they're just standing by. They're chomping at the bit. They're ready to go.
So those next steps will be to get the new lab up and running in the months ahead, get all of those old kits sent for testing by this October, and have those tests completed by 2021.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Daily dose of kindness now. Last week in Cahokia, Kansas, a school resource officer, Roger Gemelez, was out on patrol because students were on spring break. So while on patrol, he happened to pull over 22-year-old Kashawn Baldwin over expired plates. And it turns out Kashawn also had an expired driver's license. He explained to the officer he was on his way to a job interview. He had to drive to get there, and he was running late. Incredibly, the officer extended a dose of kindness rather than a ticket.
He was polite when I pulled him over and seemed like a good young man, so I wanted to give him a chance. Knew if I gave him a bunch of tickets and towed his car, you know, it'd be tough to recover from.
Officer Gemelez actually drove him to the job interview.
Thank you. Thank you for not writing me tickets. Thank you for not taking me to jail or taking the car, because the outcome could have been totally different from what it was. I just want to say thank you.
And maybe the best news of all, Kashawn got the job.
It's time now for the Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is, Sports Radio's number one buzzer beater, Danny O'Neill. We don't talk about the NBA much here for obvious reasons, but last night's playoff game between the Trail Blazers and the Thunder was amazing. The score was tied at 115 apiece, 2 seconds left on the clock. And who's this guy?
Dave, you're buried in the lead. Oklahoma City lost.
Oh, so
they
lost
in the most excruciating fashion.
Do we have to play
fantastic.
The song then?
Yes.
We have
hit
to play
it,
the song.
Hit it, hit it.
Oklahoma, where the balls won't go into the net. No, you can't avoid the schadenfreude of Seattle fans who will forget. So we say, choke. Oklahoma, you can see how bitter we remain. Being in a town with no rebounds, where the only dribble is the rain. There's nothing that smells quite as sweet as the sweat of your crushing defeat. So when we say, choke, you took our team away. Choke, we're simply saying, you've got what's mine. Choke, Oklahoma, and it's so not okay. It's C-H-O-K-E, choke, Oklahoma.
It's a civic holiday.
Are you happy now?
Yeah, I am. I'm ecstatic.
Can we talk about what happened, though?
Sure. It was tied. Well, okay, first, we got to set the scene, because yes. Oklahoma City was, they were on their way to defeat at halftime. It really looked good. Paul George hit a buzzer beater right before half to cut the deficit to 2. They hung in there, and in the third quarter, Oklahoma City started pulling away. It got a little bit larger in the fourth quarter. 6 minutes to go, Oklahoma City's up 11. 2 minutes to go, Oklahoma City's up 6. And what happened?
Damian Lillard.
Oklahoma!
He not only scores a three-pointer, he steps back almost to center court.
Yeah, it was a 37-foot shot. Whoa. Right in Oklahoma City's eye.
Here's how it went.
To send the Thunder home. Lillard, long-range three. And it's good! At the buzzer! Damian Lillard! Are you kidding me?
Blazers win.
Even the announcers are losing their minds.
Of course they were. It was unbelievable. It was absolutely. Lillard scored their final 5 points. He finished with 50, and then he waved just a little bye-bye to Oklahoma City because they were eliminated. It should be a civic holiday. It should be, and I don't know what the name of the civic holiday is. Maybe it's OKC Eats It Day or something like this, but this is the one time where I get to feel so like unrestrained joy. Someone else's misery. It's awesome.
I can see that. What was amazing to me was how cool he was, because the clock's running, on the screen there, and it's counting down, and he's just timing it, and the defender is in front of him, but doesn't know what to do because he's just backing up. So I guess he figures, he's going to pass it. But no, he just stands there and says, bloop, right through the net.
He waited so long, and Paul George is taller than Damian Lillard. He waited so long, George thought he's got to go now, and he's going to get closer. Instead, he got further away, and George jumped a little bit too soon, and Lillard got a clean shot. Bang! Mm. The sound of their collective hearts breaking was just awesome.
Are Oklahoma City fans insufferable?
Well,
they will be now.
I would say this. They're fans, and the fact that I search on Twitter for the hashtag that they use, Thunder Up, to then troll them.
Danny!
Yeah. Some of them,
so they're not the insufferable ones.
Probably not. Somebody said, Royce Young, who covers Oklahoma City, said, the big question going forward, how much gas does Lillard have left? And if not enough, can McCollum pick him up? So after he hit the shot, I was like, hey, Royce, do you get tired? That happened? You get tired? OKC said, Russell's getting fire emoji, Thunder Up. I was like, how about now? Or this, Corey Holland, here I am again, watching a 9:30 p.m. Thunder tip-off, knowing full well my heart will likely get crushed again, and I'll be a zombie tomorrow. My name is Corey, and I'm addicted to being disappointed by the OKC Thunder. I told him, your tears are delicious.
Danny, you are your best self today, and I am so happy for that.
I'm petty.
This is
I'm
what we so do now instead petty. Of poetry readings. Of live
trolling.
Twitter readings.
Yeah, live Twitter readings.
You, at
Twitter
least you troll under your own name.
That's true.
So you're brave enough. You have the guts to troll under your own name.
Yes.
Say, Frank Clark is gone.
Gone.
Was this a good deal? What
Did
they get in return?
They got a first-round pick this year, and they got a second-round pick in next year's draft. It's way more than I thought they'd get. I'm surprised. It's similar to the haul that they gave up to acquire Percy Harvin back in 2013. They got a similar amount to what they gave up to get Harvin. It's an impressive return. I think long-term this helps Seattle. I don't think it makes him a better team for next season, and that's the reason that I'm surprised that they ended up trading it. And maybe it got to a point where there were just too many draft picks involved that they couldn't, the value of being able to get cost controlled labor for the next 4 to 5 years. They're going to get two starting caliber players, and they're going to pay those guys about 10% of what Frank Clark was going to make under his new contract. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee they're going to get one, let alone two guys that were as good as Frank Clark. Frank Clark's really good player. I think they're going to miss him in the upcoming season, and I think that they're betting on the ability to have more depth going forward will be better for him. That Frank Clark, re-signing Frank Clark wasn't going to make them great. That he's a good player, and they need to get other guys if they're going to truly make that vault into being a great defense again.
Daniel Neal, our sports insider, Choklahoma.
Choklahoma! Yeah. Eat it, suckers!
Sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. You would think with all the Democrats running for president, there'd be none left to run for Seattle City Council. But turns out there are plenty. And the big issues are homelessness and public safety. Last night it was a District 6 candidate forum. Councilman Mike O'Brien is giving up his seat, and a lot of people want it. Cairo Radio's Aaron Granillo talked to voters at a crowded forum in Finney Ridge. What did they say?
Well, this race is flooded, as you said. 12 registered candidates. They want to represent that area. It includes Ballard, Green Lake, Crown Hill, 10 of those hopefuls made their case last night to dozens of voters like James Daly.
I have a couple of candidates that I knew about and liked, and I'm having a difficult time because I like several of them, actually.
Now, Daly says it's a tough choice because all of these candidates seem to agree that current policies aren't tackling his top concern, homelessness.
I think some of that is just a natural reaction to sort of seeing what's happened in the city over the last few years and the property crimes and the garbage that you see and the tents. And as a lot of the candidates said, it's not humane to let people live in these conditions.
So he likes people who have prior government experience. He appreciates people like current council aide Dan Strauss. You also have former Seattle councilwoman Heidi Wills. She has the most...
I remember Heidi Wills.
Yes, you do. Yes, she has the most name recognition in this race. And she also got the loudest crowd reaction last night for her stance on illegal encampments.
The city can no longer condone people sleeping in tents in our public parks and our public spaces.
So she's saying we can no longer condone people in tents in public spaces.
Exactly. That's what she's saying. So she has an idea, as do many other candidates, that she supports ideas like FEMA-style tents, those large sanctioned encampments that some other cities have implemented with wraparound services. And again, she's not the only candidate to say that. You have Fremont physician Jay Fatih, who supports the idea. Sergio Garcia, he's a Seattle police officer who thinks the illegal encampments also need to go. And then you have voters like Ballard resident Erica Nagy. She agrees with them.
They're not willing to accept shelter, and if they're not willing to accept when we have enough mental health or rehab services, if they're refusing services altogether, we absolutely cannot allow them to continue to refuse services, but then therefore continue to destroy our parks and our streets.
Okay, so what do you do with them? I asked her. I mean, do you do things like involuntary treatments? Do you send them to jail? I mean, what do you do? She says, well, she doesn't want to go that far, but she just wants to see laws on the books enforced.
This is not the police's fault. They're arresting the people, and you know, the public defenders and the prosecuting attorney's office is just letting them right back out.
Yeah, which is true. And they're frustrated, too, because the law really doesn't allow them to hold them. And the drug court, where you actually can compel people to get treatment on pain of jail time, is run by the county.
Right.
And Seattle doesn't have anything similar to that. Mm-hmm. This is very significant because Mike O'Brien, one of the most liberal council members, mm-hmm. and this district, one, you know, if you can distinguish between the degrees of liberality in Seattle, is one of the more liberal. So would you say the crowd that turned up then was, is there any way to tell whether it's indicative of the district as a whole, or are these the people who just felt the most motivated to come and complain?
It's hard to say. I mean, again, I've gone to 5 of these forums now, and I think, you know, these are not rah-rah go current city council forums, right? These are people who come out who want to see change. And in this district, yes, O'Brien is stepping down. And a lot of the people that I talk to, they don't like him, obviously, for a number of reasons. Top of mind for a lot of people last night, you had the Ballard rape victim who just released her video recounting her experience at a car dealership. And they're saying, you know, this shouldn't happen. This woman was assaulted by a man from Texas who had a warrant out for his arrest, and he was allowed to stay at a tiny house village, at a Nicholsville encampment. This shouldn't be happening. Let me play one more soundbite from a voter. This guy is Benjamin Hall. He's more of a hardliner in this district. He says, if you break the law, you should go to jail. You should stay there, and you need to undergo rehab.
Nobody's doing drugs in jail. Nobody's overdosing in jail. Nobody's living in a tent, selling, shooting, kidnapping, whatever, sex trafficking. That's not happening in jail. So if you want to talk about harm reduction strategies, like, that's a harm reduction strategy.
None of the candidates went that far last night. The majority of them say, you know, more resources for mental health services, more shelters, job training, and, of course, added options for affordable housing.
Well, we heard from Judge Ed McKenna, municipal court judge, former prosecuting attorney, who thinks that the unused space in the King County Jail, of which there are like 400 beds, ought to be turned into a secured treatment center. Instead, it's going to be used to house homeless people. But that's an example of one of the options that a new city council might want to take advantage of.
Exactly. And a lot of people are saying there's a lot of unused land around the city and around the county. Those can also be places for things like those FEMA-style tents. Yeah.
Cairo Radio's Aaron Granillo. Aaron, thank you.
Thank you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Can you imagine anything worse than abusing an old person? And I say that being a fairly old person myself, I can't imagine anything worse than abusing an old person. And apparently, though, it happens all the time, as I've discovered, by talking with Amanda Froh and Paige Ulrey, who are deputy prosecuting attorneys for King County, and who have just told me that elder abuse is, I believe the word you used was rampant?
That is the word I used, yes.
Okay. And it's happening mostly at the hands of other family members?
The most common perpetrators we see are family members, but we also see caregivers. We also see people who are in a trust relationship to the elder and strangers.
And we also mentioned that it has to do with money. So let's focus on that. When you say elder abuse can be motivated by money, I'm guessing it's to get at my 401k. Is that what it's about or something else?
That's certainly one of the aspects of it. There's also a lot of theft from different sources of income for the people who have these crimes committed against them. For example, Social Security funds, mm-hmm. pensions that are a regular part of their monthly income. Any sort of income that's coming into that person's bank account is potentially exploited.
And this is children doing this?
Oftentimes, it is the child who has the legal authority to access those funds, such as a power of attorney for their parents.
Well, the power of attorney is supposed to be for the benefit of the elderly person.
That's correct. And that's why a power of attorney who is taking money for their own benefit might be committing theft because it exceeds their authority.
Okay. So how do we help people recognize it to help you in getting to the bottom of it?
There's a lot of red flags. I would say unpaid bills, changes in someone's will that they've had in place for many years, a new power of attorney, mm-hmm. transfer of a deed of a house
right.
often happens.
I think a lot of our cases, other family members might learn about the exploitation of the family member who's committing it because the older adult is complaining about something that they think that they should be able to buy, but they are told that they don't have enough money to get. Mm-hmm. For example, I think I need a new roof on the house, but so-and-so says that I can't afford that. I thought I had plenty of money. And at that point, all of the other family members start to investigate into the situation because they had assumed that their sibling had taken care of mom's finances and everything was fine. A power of attorney typically doesn't have any obligation to report to others about how they're handling that person's finances.
Right.
And so there really has to be an incident of some kind, something to tip off the suspicions of someone else to start looking into it more deeply.
The highest profile story we had about this was the Casey Kasem story, which I'm sure that you remember. So does that mean then that an elderly person should think twice before signing a power of attorney?
I think they should think twice about who they appoint as their attorney in fact, or they should think about having two people as their attorney in fact. So there's two sets of eyes on their finances. It just allows both people to have decision-making authority. So it gives both people the ability to look into the finances and make sure things are going well.
Huh.
Another aspect of a power of attorney I think that's important to consider is what we call a gifting provision, and whether there's a provision written into the power of attorney that allows the power of attorney to gift the older person's assets to themselves to a certain degree. Those provisions are often in cases that we prosecute, and certainly they are problematic often for the older adult because it gives the exploiter kind of a carte blanche at times to use that person's assets for themselves.
If you have a power of attorney appointed, that person has a fiduciary duty to spend your money only for your benefit.
Uh-huh.
So even if you have Alzheimer's and you're no longer able to make decisions, it's still a crime to be taking that person's money as attorney in fact and spending it on yourself. So they're actually very straightforward cases for us to prosecute.
So there are clear rules there.
Yes.
And do you have any particular cases that come to mind where there was difficulty in defining what constituted spending money on yourself? I mean, presumably, if you're a caregiver, you have to be able to feed yourself. You have to be able to house yourself as you're caring for somebody. You have to be able to, you know, get around. So that would allow you to buy a car, presumably, right? Or furniture, or who knows what?
Yeah, I mean, we're inundated with cases, and we're not ever going to be prosecuting a case where someone, and nor should we, where someone is spending money of an elder on things that are for the household or yeah. for their mutual benefit. It's the cases that where the suspect or the person with the power of attorney is spending money on drugs or gambling at casinos or buying themselves incredibly extravagant things, those very clear-cut cases that are likely criminal.
Hmm. I've had a couple of cases in the last few years here in King County that involved the power of attorney, in one case a son, in another case a granddaughter, who went through the victim's funds to the tune of $500,000 to $600,000 on gambling.
Wow.
Leaving those victims without any funds at all.
Wow. And how'd they do that? I mean, they just used the charge card or?
They have authority over the accounts, and so yeah. they would walk into the bank and, with an ATM and take cash out of the bank, out of the victim's
so
accounts.
They took it out in the form of cash. I was trying to think if there's
cash,
any way to put...
checks, credit, it can be all of those things.
But I was thinking, can't you put restrictions on an account saying none of this money shall be spent at a casino of any kind or, you know, in a back alley of any kind?
I don't think you can... I mean, I don't think a bank has the ability to sort yeah. of stop particular transactions like that. So I think that's very difficult to do.
But yeah. certainly it is those types of transactions that alert banks to the fact that elder financial exploitation might be occurring.
So in the casino case, who sounded the alarm there?
In one of the gambling cases, another sibling got a notice that the victim's nursing home care had not been paid.
Aha.
And this sibling didn't, like I was telling you, that trigger, right? That trigger that something isn't right. And so she started looking into it, and all of this unfolded at that point.
Uh-huh.
And that's another really common scenario we see, is where the victim has dementia, is put into a long-term care facility, and then the adult child, who's the power of attorney, ends up draining their assets and not paying for their nursing home bills. Uh-huh. So nursing homes or other long-term care facilities report frequently to
right.
us.
Nursing
so
homes.
That tells me, as the old person in this scenario, to make sure you have more than one child and that at least one of them has been properly raised. Okay, and the other thing is, get to know your banker, right? I mean, if you actually have a human contact at the bank, which is less and less normal anyway, that can also help, because they would notice something on your account that was crazy.
Yeah, and with older adults, it's not uncommon that they typically only do their banking in person at the same bank every time. And so you're right, that relationship is important.
Yeah.
Another preventative thing to do that I've been hearing more about is basically creating what's similar to an advanced care directive for your assets should you become demented or cognitively impaired as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
And so really planning out with your family and maybe even with your lawyer, you know, what do you want to have happen with your assets and your decision making should you no longer be able to make good decisions?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Amanda Froh and Paige Ulrey from King County Prosecutor's Office, thank you very much. Good luck with your work. We old people are depending on you.
Thank you.